Yo, what is a cypher?
You're with the guy in the studio earlier, prior, and then you're in the sound factory, and there's a guy getting thrown on stage.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher, and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 117, A Talk with K-Def. Kevin K-Def Hansford is a New Jersey-based producer with a long and storied history. He hooked up with legendary producer Marley Marl in the early 1990s and became a key part of Marley's famed studio, The House of Hits. While under Marley's wing, he produced great records for Tragedy, The Youngsters, and more. But it was his work with Lords of the Underground that would really cement his reputation. He produced half a dozen songs on the group's classic debut, 1993's Here Come the Lords, including the omnipresent Chief Rocka. K-Def's duo Real Live, with his cousin Larry O, would release one excellent album, 1996's The Turnaround, A Long-Awaited Drama, which included the hit song Real Live Shit. But industry drama, detailed in our conversation, would derail the group before it really got started. Despite that, K-Def's production career continued apace, landing him songs with Ghostface, Diddy, UGK, Old Dirty Bastard, and more. In recent years, he's released a number of stellar instrumental works on Redefinition Records and continues to find new ways to expand the palette of sample-based music. We talked to K-Def at the home of Redefinition Records head John Noder Francesco in northern New Jersey.
Hey everyone, it's Josh, the producer of The Cypher. John at Redefinition Records has offered us some great prizes for a few of our listeners, so here's what we're going to do. While listening to this episode, listen and write down the answer to the following two questions. Number one, which artists wound up with a K-Def beat that was originally supposed to be on Illmatic? And number two, what song does K-Def credit with marking the end of sampler-based hip-hop? Send your answers in an email to contest@thecyphershow.com by September 7th, 2015, and you'll be entered to win one of the three prizes. No purchase necessary, of course, because we don't sell anything. You can find more information in the credits of this episode or on our Facebook page.
If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 32, where we talk to Big Daddy Kane about his own experiences with Marley Marl. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, the only man who could turn The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh into a hit song, here's K-Def. We were talking about a second ago, you know, we had a buddy who used to work at the Princeton Record Exchange.
Right.
And, you know, not to date you, but I know you were digging there probably like mid-80s or something?
I was there... 90, 91, 92, okay. Anywhere from probably 90 to about 94, 95, I was going like constantly. I mean, I bought some of my best records actually down there.
We might have overlapped. That was around the time we were going there a lot and had friends working there.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, I used to see so much stuff down there. It was just like, they never actually would let you know, this is what the hip hoppers buy. It was just, you go in there and you find some stuff and whatever you find. I used to be just static. Great, great stuff.
And they had the bins underneath the bins, yep, right?
Exactly.
With all the secret stuff.
And the funny thing is, when I used to go in there, it was like, there was never nobody in there familiar. So it was just like, I walked in there. I see a lot of old guys in there. They're looking for Frank Sinatra or whatever they're looking for. And I would just go, wow. It's like, this place was great. And it would always update records in there. So no matter, every time I went in there, there was always like new stuff. So it was like, it was fun. The prices wasn't too bad either, but
yeah.
I loved it. I loved the spot. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. And one of the things about digging that I know with you is, you know, when you started comparatively early, you know, for compared to like a lot of other producers and stuff.
Right.
By the time, you know, 92, 93, when a lot of these, you know, more obscure, when sampling had moved beyond the sort of canon of James Brown related stuff and got into jazz.
Right.
These were breaks you knew already.
Right. My dad just, you know, my dad was listening to Lee Morgan, Jimmy Smith, like the Blue Notes were like retarded. I didn't like them when I was young, because the horns and stuff was just like, you know, it was a lot of, some of it was bebop jazz. It wasn't so much funky stuff, but it was only until I think probably 91, I went down to my cousin's house down in Plainfield, and he had the Ronnie Laws album, Tidal Wave. When I heard that, and I looked in the back, and it was a little funky. It wasn't straight ahead. It was more, had some kind of, you know, 4-4 kind of thing going on. I was like, wow, this is cool. As soon as I got back, looped that up, and before Black Moon used Who Got the Props, they got no show, so I'ma grab the mic, flip a strip, believe the stun. Buckshot's the one that gets the job done. Mic check. I had did that beat about a year or so before anybody even heard it. And then I found out about Leo Morris, Idris Muhammad. Just like Blue Note Fest, you know. And you know, luckily for me, my dad was into like all kind of records, like classical and reggae and rock, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and you know, the Eagles, and just weird stuff, you know what I'm saying. And I didn't really understand it. My mom's was like more or less Isley Brothers and you know, James Brown and the whole Motown sound and all that stuff. So I had a variety of different things to hear, but the jazz breaks was the ones that not too many sampling guys knew about, you know? So James Brown was the quote, the main thing. Everybody wanted James Brown. But when I got my hands on the jazz, I just went, I went crazy with it. Then we got to, you know, it was easy for me to use the Blue Notes because we had a deal with Blue Note, the label. They actually gave us a straight $500 buyout. So it was like anything we sampled from them was $500.
Wow. Was that exclusive to you? Were they doing that a lot?
Yeah, me and Marley. Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Me and Marley. So we both, you know, it was really more Marley, but I was part of the house.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, we had that going on, and it was just like there were more jazz records than the funk and the rock and the soul. It was just, you know, I mean, we're not even going to talk about away from Blue Note. Because, you know, eventually Blue Note wound up doing breakbeat compilations and they started adding all the breaks from Turtle Walk and Lou Donaldson and, you know, all these other. But before that, it was like he was on a massive hunt to find, you know, the illest jazz records you could find, you know, so.
Yeah. So what was it like for you? Like, you're doing this stuff like 90, 91 and then like 92, 93 hits and you have a Black Moon and Tribe doing the same stuff you were doing before and they're having hits with it.
Well, you know, it was, I would say that those guys and a lot of that stuff that came out, it was inspiration to me. I got with Marley like in 93. And right before I got with Marley in 93, you know, you had, I think it was Gangstar, Tribe, and, you know, a few other groups that were using jazz. And those guys were all inspiration. So I would have the breaks that these guys used, but they came out with them first. But I did ideas with them myself, but just I wasn't in the scene yet. So it was like those guys were inspiration and it helped me even go even further, just finding more and more and more and more jazz records. So,
you know, being a Jersey native myself,
Right.
You know, I was curious about something I heard you say about like the difference between New York and New Jersey as far as hip hop goes. Sure, it was created in New York and that's where a lot of the vital stuff was happening, but New Jersey was where the business side of it was concentrated.
Exactly. Right. So Wonder Mike from Sugar Hill Gang is my cousin. And, you know, Sugar Hill at the time, one of the guys from the family, Leland Robinson, he was the one that actually, you know, basically, I think it was like, what, 88? Yeah, 88. No, actually, it was probably 87. Yeah, in 87, you know, I was doing mad parties and DJing locally, Inglewood, Hackensack, Teaneck, Passaic, Patterson, all those places. And one day, Leland was like, you know, I think highly of you, man. I think you like, you know what I'm saying? You like, you really dope. Wanna start messing with you a little bit more. And mind you, when we talk about, you know, the Jersey rap, as far as we getting money here, it was like, you know, I always say it like, you know, hip hop started in the parks, probably in NYC and the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens and all that. But we were the ones that actually, you know, took it to where the world could hear it.
Sugar Hill Records, based in Englewood, New Jersey, and run by the husband and wife team of Joe and Sylvia Robinson, was a label that housed many influential early rap groups like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Treacherous Three, The Sequence, and the Funky Four Plus One. Most crucially, though, in 1979, they released rap's very first hit song, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang. That song hit the charts not only in the U.S., but also in Germany, Canada, Switzerland, Sweden, Austria, the U.K., and many other countries throughout the world.
And I think that gets overlooked a lot, you know what I'm saying? Just because, you know, we were kind of the first to do it here. And I watched it evolve. Rapper's Delight came out. That was good times. But then Bounce Rock Skate and Vaughn Mason came out, and that sounded like good times. You know what I'm saying? And those are the things that we were doing here in Jersey. It wasn't like someone else did it. You know, they eventually did it in other states and everything. But the main thing was that we were into the regeneration of some of these records that were classics that was on the radio all day long. We were the ones who were actually doing it first. And they were using bands. They wasn't even sampling. They were actually playing the stuff over, which we couldn't really do. But it gave me insight to know that, you know, we were on the jump of, you know what? These guys are setting a pavement and a way for us to be able to take the sampling thing a little bit further. And more it got recognized and more it blew up, you know, it was just like, wow, you know, I like to this day, you know, the tri-state area is like, we're the ones that created it, man. And like, we're the ones that should not be following anything or nobody. We should be staying true to what it is. I know the sample laws is crazy. I know the publishers and the lawyers are involved and it's, you know, we need to go to Congress and try to get some kind of thing worked out where, you know, the publisher be a little lenient, take 25, we take 25 and everybody's happy. We make money. It's not that way, but that would be nice. But, you know, that determined a lot of where we at today as far as not being able to sample and do what we originally started back then. So, but yeah, I mean, you know.
Do you remember your cousin having that hit record?
Yes.
You're probably pretty young.
Right. I was a teenager. I met my cousin Larry O in 87. And that's when he put me up onto it. It was like, yo,
right.
You know that's your cousin, right? And it was like, really? And he was like, yeah. And then, like I said, Leland Robinson came through. Leland Robinson was the one that gave me my first SP-12. And that's how I got to know more about, you know, Sugar Hill. I used to go to the place in Englewood. I learned a lot of history as far as, you know, the Sequence. The guy named Billy Jones, he was playing all the guitars and stuff and all their hit records and stuff. And I got more and more close to Big Joe Robinson, rest in peace. And, you know, they kind of like put me under the wing, if you would say, you know what I'm saying? And I had this thing where like, yo, we from Jersey, you know, I'm loving this. And, you know, Leland knew I was just, you know, killing it DJing because that's what I was doing first. And, you know, and 88 was the chance that, you know, they got me and my cousin Larry O a record deal. And, you know, and from there, you know what I'm saying? I felt like, yo, you know, he bought me an MPC 60. You know what I'm saying? He got my first MPC 60 that I still have today.
You said there was no manual. They custom, beautiful no, custom case.
Right. It was but no manual whatsoever, and a big red velvet custom made case that weighed more than an MP that went inside of it. And I lugged that thing around, and I think I just used it. But yeah, I learned that thing literally in about less than 2 weeks, inside out. And it was great, man. And that helped me, actually, that was the form of me. Once I got the MPC 60, that helped me get going with just digging. So basically, 88 was the year I just started breaks, going all over. Music Factory, Colony Records, Princeton Record Exchange. Oh, I was ready for all of it. And, you know, basically, that's what I was really into, you know what I'm saying, at that time. And even back then, the records were expensive.
We had 88 Keys on the show, and he actually used to work for, forget his name, but the guy at the Roosevelt Record Conventions with a big beard, the big biker dude.
John Carrero.
88 Keys was his assistant, right. And he used to talk about seeing records for, you know, $1,000 and things like that.
Yeah, I remember we used to be 5:30 in the morning, standing outside. I would see every producer imaginable, I mean, was there.
All waiting for Prince B to finish shopping.
Here's 88 Keys on Cypher episode 84.
You know, Prince B from PM Dawn, he was John's biggest customer. Like, he would just drop racks and racks and racks on, you know, records, like, easy. And it actually became a situation, like, 1 year, where John wouldn't open up his table to anybody. Like, he wouldn't let anybody purchase records until Prince B came through. And people were upset. Like, you know, like, and during that time, it was like the Beat Miners, Buck Wild, OG, you know, Q-Tip, the Beat Junkies, you know, just like every New York producer or like right outside the New York producers who were like prevalent in the mid-90s who were like doing their thing, like, everybody hit up the Roosevelt Record Convention. And them particularly, they would pay the extra like 20 or 40 or whatever it was to get in early, like to get in before they open. They actually opened the doors to the public. And so John was like, nope, you gotta wait till Prince B. I'm waiting for Prince B. And then people were just like, ah, just kind of effed up. But that's how he rolled.
Exactly. Exactly. It was like, you know, I'm coming from Jersey, so I'm out here and I'm like, yo, why are we standing out here? Like, we're here early to get in early because we know it's going to be a lot of people coming and there's going to be a frenzy in here. Oh, we're waiting for Prince B. He's, you know, doing his thing. I'm like, what do you mean doing his thing? I mean, come on, man, let's go. You know what I'm saying? And like, yo, when he's in there spending mad money, everybody has to wait. And it got to the point where it was like, I think every convention was almost like that. It was either not him, but either another producer that just had a gazillion amount of money to go in and be like, look, shut this down till I get what I want to get. And I'm going to go out the back and then you can open it up, you know?
So that no one would see him later.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, but yes, I mean, Salam Remy, SNS, I think it was Buck Wild. I would see just, it was just chaotic.
Yeah. So on the production tip, was the first professional thing you did, was it that NOG record?
We didn't get in there so you can get in with us. You wasn't down when we was riding the bus. So put on your Adidas and step off. I got the hat.
No need for me. That was like 91, I think.
I was part of the NOG's album. I did a lot of little things there, scratching, sample ideas, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I think there's one song where you're a credited producer on it.
Well, I don't know. The credits were
a little weird
back then, you know? So,
yeah.
But me and Awesome 2, you know, Special K, Teddy Ted, you know, they were another ones that I got to credit a lot to because they were in my corner. since I was a teenager, and they were the ones that actually had me hooked up. It was a group called Side Effects. They were based in Florida. That was the first thing I think I really did some work in with sampling and part of a song. I ain't really get no credit on that neither, but you know.
Yeah.
But LG was probably the first thing I got my feet wet, and then from there, you know, I eventually, not too much later after that, hooked up with Marley.
Right. Right. And so, yeah, so you hooked up with Marley Marl. You said, like,
oh, before Marley Marl, though, there was KRS-One. And me and Larry O were dealing with KRS-One.
Your cousin was closer to him than you were. He was your initial connection.
My cousin's sister, Faith, was actually dating ICU. And we did a song with Chris called Uncontrollable. And one day, just so happens to be, they go back into the studio without me, and they change the whole song. And, of course, you know, me and Larry went at it, and we both separate our ways, and I wind up...
This was the first time Real Live broke up.
Yeah. Yeah. We were on Tab Dash Records in Harlem, and we was label mates with R. Kelly. And I don't know. I think Dave got arrested, and he disappeared, and we never really dropped nothing, but... At that time, Chris was trying to come in and kind of like be a manager kind of thing and kind of like guide it. And then when they did that song and it was like, yo, thought we was all down. What's going on? And it is what it is. You know what I'm saying? And me and Larry went back and it was just, that was it. We broke up, left. And then about maybe 2 months later, I got jumped. And, you know, one of my boys was Marley's cousin, came out of jail. He said, yo, do 10 songs for me. And we'll get on. Did the 10 songs, and Marley wasn't really feeling the songs, but he was feeling the beats.
Yeah.
And I think it had to be no more than 2-3 days later, if that, Marley's ringing my doorbell, ding, ding. Who is it? It's Marley. Kay, what's up? Come downstairs. It's Marley.
Brett, and this is the thing that, you know, in sort of the age of the internet, people have to remember, it's not like you knew him.
Nope.
And it's not like he called before he showed up at your house.
Right. He just showed up. Right. And it was like, you know, we got to understand today's generation is a little blessed today. And there's so much opportunity availability to matter whoever it may be, from the biggest to the smallest person. Back then, you had to have a name for what you was doing out in the streets. And you had somebody who had to be willing enough to actually put a good word in for you. And you have something to show for them to actually want to, like I said, he's from Queensbridge. He had, you know, he was upstate New York. He decided to come down and he's working on the Lords of the Underground. They just had Psycho out. And I just came in at a great situation where it was like Funky Chow, Here Comes the Lords, From the Bricks,
yeah, Chief Rocker. We'll get to all of those. Right. Don't worry about it. Right. We'll get to all that stuff. So the thing about Marley and your work with him is like, I want to hone in on one moment that I heard you talk about because it just seems so nuts to me. You said one of the first things he did when you got there was he gave you the original multi-track master at a Children's Story.
Y'all tucked in? Here we go. Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow, we laws were stuck.
Right.
And was like, yeah, just see what you can do with this.
Right, right. Like, I came up there, I had my machine. And I'm looking around. I'm like, wow, I'm up at the house. I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. So at the time, I think there was a session going on in the A room. So we went to the B room. And I was like, yo, I'm here. I want to do something. What you got? Let's do something. Oh, okay, hold up. Went to the A room. He pulled the tape out and said, he said, you know anything about Simpty and locking stuff up? I was like, no, but I'll figure it out. What's up? He's like, yo, I'm thinking about doing some remix to Rick's on first album. I got his stuff, and I'm like, you know, I want to do some, you know, remixes. You know, see what you can come up with. And I never forget, there were two songs. I think it was Children's Story and The Moment I Feared. And Children's Story, I was just like so gassed. I was just like, Rick the Ruler, Marley Marl, what the hell? It was like, you know, DJ K Def. I had one test. I had to acetate of me and Larry what we did with KRS-One. And I used, what was it, Dimples D? Yeah, Dimples D. When she goes, Marley Marl's one hell of a man.
When the time was up, they just couldn't. couldn't believe what the man Marley Marl has just achieved. To get the people dancing on the wackiest jam, cause Marley Marl is one hell of a man. So to those,
and I use that, and then I use Rick the Ruler.
That's right, Rick the Ruler presentation.
I just took Skull Snaps. And I don't know what that damn jazz sample was, but it was some piano jazz sample. It wasn't the greatest beat and all, but it was the fact that I was so amped and I wanted to show him I wanted to work that I was just down.
He said, "Keep still, boy, no need for static." Punched him in his belly and he gave him a slap. But little did he know the little boy was strapped. The kid pulled out a gun, he said, "Watch you hit."
You know, and more and more and more, you know, I was able to get my hands on a lot of the stuff. It was Moni Love stuff there. There was some Heavy D stuff there. And I would just take stuff up, man, and just lock Cynthia up when I figured out what time code was and when the tape started and how to lock it up. And the B room wound up being my best friend because I wound up living in there practically because that was the spot, you know? So, and all well, you know what I'm saying? It was just like, go in, show and prove, or, you know, you can see the door. So next.
Yeah, time. I mean, that's pretty intense to be told right off the bat, hey, just take one of the most famous songs of in rap history and just make it better.
Yeah, well, I didn't even know he had multis because I didn't even know that, you know what I'm saying? And it was just like he had that there and it was nothing to him. It was just like, yeah, you know, here, take this.
Yeah.
And it was great, man. It was great.
But, I mean, interestingly, when you talk about that time, you know, it was challenging and, like, you learned a lot and all that stuff. But you said once that it wasn't very much fun.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. And for young, aspiring beat maker, wanting to be a producer, I'm from Jersey. I was by myself. I didn't have an entourage or a crew or a clique with me at the time. So it was just me against the world. And I had an opportunity to think about it and say, do I want to go and party and have fun and trick my money and do all this, that, and the third? Or do I want to sit here and try to be the best producer ever while I'm under this guy, Marley Marl, which I already respected him as one of the greatest because he was the one that enlightened me about sampling from the door. So, you know, I stayed stuck in the studio. It was like being in a cave. Yo, Kay, man, we going to the club. You coming? Nah. Damn, bro, you never want to go out, man. What's up, man? Come on, man, live a little. And it was just like, you know, you got to understand, if you want to be a producer doing this, you got to understand, I didn't get a chance to work with all those artists if I'd have been out partying. You know what I'm saying? There was a lot of artists that came through the house. Everybody and their mama was coming through the House of Hits. Whether they had a deal, didn't have a deal, whether they were known or not known, they were coming in there. And I had an opportunity to go, well, you know what? I'm trying to make a name for myself, and I'm not guaranteed tomorrow. So it was like I could take it for granted and go, oh, I'm just going to ride on the Marley and just chill out, just take it as it comes. Or I was like, you know what? I want to show these guys I'm the real deal. And so, you know, there was a lot of sleepless nights. There were a lot of lockout sessions where there were 10 hours, you know, 12 hours. And, you know, it was just grueling, gruesomeness, you know. So, but the end of the day is it was at times very stressful because you had to deal with artist egos. You know, some of them felt like you're just here. You know, you don't really care about this group. You're just here doing it just so you can get a check, you know? And that's the mentality was because I wasn't part of that family, if you know what I mean. I was really like a hired help kind of guy, but me and Marley were really cool. So it was like, I was part of the house, but you know, the end of the day is, you know, I had to deal with the egos. I had to deal with timing.
Wait, in artists, egos? Come on.
Yo, it was just retarded. I was retarded. It was like, you know, they showed Marley the love because he was the mentor. He was the guy with the respect. Mm-hmm. He was the guy that could get the deal, get the checks cut. And then it was me. You know, you're just here. You know, you're working. You know, you're just here working for the house. And, you know, you're good and you're cool, but I really don't have to really answer to you. And at the end of the day, it's like, you know, and I got that. And that was cool. But that really made me work even harder.
Yeah. And like one of the, you know, I wanted to dig in, like, one of the more iconic projects you did when you were there was the first Lords of the Underground record.
Right.
Which, you know, you did a bunch of great songs on there. Right. So first off, Funky Child, which you mentioned, is super well known in no small part because of that crazy trumpet or piccolo trumpet or whatever it is.
Yeah. Born in the underground of Newark, now witness the birth of Mr. Funky.
Right. Oh, but it wasn't sampled. It was a replay.
It was replayed.
Yes.
Wow. So how on earth did you find it? Because the original is the end of a song on a soundtrack to a movie that no one's heard.
Right.
How did you find it? And how did you think that, like, this little lick in a trumpet solo would be great for a rap song?
Okay, that's a great question. In 89, there was a guy that came by my house one day. He was riding around, and I'm just sitting in front of my house, and he drives up, and he goes, yo, I got VHS tapes. What? I got VHS tapes of nothing but black exploitation movies. What are you talking about? I'm going to show you. He pops his trunk open, and he has like 30 VHS tapes of whatever movie you can imagine. He's like, yo, I'll give you every tape, $10 each. And back then, you got to understand, I just got my MPC 60. So I was the sample king. I wanted to sample everything. I would sample your voice if it was on whatever. So I bought all these tapes from him. Spent like about $150, $200. So I'm watching The Fist to Save Pittsburgh. And in the movie, he's dropped, this balloon is dropping down. But there's a crowd there.
All around me, incredible as the Pisces make their way from the sky.
And the first thing I'm thinking is, yo, that would be nice. But the crowd was destroying it. So I was like, oh, this is just, it's too loud and noisy. So it's funny you mentioned Princeton Record Exchange, because I went down there with my man from Patterson, because he told me about a dude named Stanley Cowell that was on Muse Records, Strata East. And he was telling me about this record. And he was like, yo, I think they got it down there. We're going to go down there. So I go down there and I see the soundtrack to The Fist to Save Pittsburgh. And it's a promo. $12. I buy it. Now, mind you, there's a few other breaks that other rappers used on the album later down in the 90s, but I wasn't paying attention to that. So I'm playing the song. I'm in the house chilling, whatever, because back then, usually what I would do is play a record and then just basically move around the house, get something to drink, talk on the phone. Somebody come through. I just let a record play, and that horn came in, and I said, now that would be actually interesting. And it was quiet with no crowd at all. And like you said, it was the song that starts off, doesn't end like that. Where the horn comes in at, all the music stops and it just goes. I think the song's going off. Then the horn comes in. I'm like, oh, I'm sampling that. Now, I didn't know about what I was going to add to it, because in previous interviews, I've always told most people that I wasn't a fan of Funky Child. And maybe because it had so many samples in it. And when I got with Marley, it was literally like, I'm not going to see any money on this.
Right. If this guy wants 100% and this guy right. wants 100%.
There was a lot going on in yeah. there. So when I heard the record, I was like, oh, that's cool. That's cool. And it was, I really took it as another beat. But at the end of the day is, I can't explain to you what enticed me to just pick that one little horn sample. But what did entice me was, I had just got my hands on Skull Snaps. It's a New Day drums. And I was just looking eager to put anything to the drums that I could find, being honest with you. And I was caught in a black exploitation movie VHS tape thing. And then I just got my hands on Skull Snaps and Hihachi, Nobody Beats the Biz drums. I got Hihachi and Skull Snaps album at the same time, and I was just sampling everything and putting it with the drums. And actually, I can literally definitively say I have about 30 beats with Skull Snap drums. at that time. I was just sampling everything with him because it was just like, yo, this was the hottest beat ever. I mean, Steezo used it. And, you know, everybody sampled Steezo's version. Even Primo, you know what I'm saying? For Take It Personal was Steezo. No, I didn't know too many people had the skull snaps. Marley had it, though. But I had it before Marley, you know what I'm saying? But I found Marley had it, too. He was like, whoa. So, yeah, but... That was a definitely weird track that I really wasn't a fan of, but they loved it.
Right. And it, yeah, definitely has caught on. So the, on that record, I noticed on your tracks, vocal samples are a big thing.
Right.
How did that become an important part of the sound of that record?
You know what? I would have to credit a lot of the records that came before. You know, I mean, you had, you know, Gangstar. You know, Primo was, you know, Primo. Even Law Finesse's first album, Funky Technician album, was another album that, you know, they would just, ain't that something? Damn, it feels good to see people. Ain't that something? Damn, it feels good to see people up on it. That was the thing, you know, and I just, I don't know. I think that was probably inspiration from the other guys I was listening to, and I just wanted to fit in and, like, you know, I could do it my way too, you know?
Yeah. So there was a little bit of controversy around that record. I don't even know if you were aware of it at the time or if you're aware of it now. You did a remix of Chief Rocka.
Right.
And he used the same bass line as Hold Your Head from Showbiz and AG.
Right.
And then AG dissed Lords of the Underground after that. Fake lords, they get strangled with mic cord. Taking beats from my LP for sure ain't healthy. Patterson Project. Were you aware of that when that was going on?
Well, the thing was that I was aware of it.
Had you heard the Showbiz song before you did your remix?
And the thing is that, like I alluded to with Black Moon as well, it was like there were a lot of breaks that I just had. And some things I just didn't want to go down, but it was out of my control, if you know what I mean. I don't cut the checks. I don't tell people what they can and what they can't use. It was like, look, I work for this production company, that I make what I make, and if they like it, I have no control to say, don't put it out, don't do this and that, so-and-so use it. I have no control over that. I was doing my job, you know what I'm saying? And it wasn't no attack on anybody. But, you know, if the artists are screaming for something and then, you know, the production company is saying we're going to use it and then the record label saying we're going to put it out, who am I to tell them not to do it? You know, I just didn't have that control. I was part of the production company. It wasn't like I was running the show. So, you know, the end of the day is there was a few records that were done that, you know, questionably may not should have come out because I have a thing about biting. I know about biting. You don't really do that. Back then, it was a serious thing. And you know what? Like I said, it wasn't, to me, there was nothing intentional towards them at all with that. You know what I'm saying? Because like I said, I had a few records that I did that before people actually came out with them, I did the beats already. You know, they weren't the same beat. You know what I'm saying? But Jack Bruce is Jack Bruce. I mean, you know, you got to break. It was... I can't explain it to you no more. I mean, no one can claim a break. You don't own it. It's, you know, it's supposed to be, the rule is first come, first serve. Whoever uses it first and gets prosecuted first, you leave it alone. That was the way it was. But when you're dealing with stronger powers above you, you can't make that decision.
Yeah. The second Lords of the Underground album, some of the stuff you worked on for that seemed like a little jazzier. It seemed like the arrangements were maybe like a little more involved.
Look into my eyes, hear my name.
Fear no man, feel no pain.
Mr. Funky Man, show no shame.
Fear no man, feel no pain.
Everybody walk like the man, talk like the man. You can be your man, but not Mr. Funky Man. Cause a lot of people say Mr. Funky.
Then the stuff on the debut, which was maybe a little more aggressive, like... From your perspective, what changed on the Keepers of the Funk?
Sample clearances was one problem. I wasn't involved as much on that album as I was the first one. And basically, you know, I think War and Now, Trage. Yeah, War and Now and Trage were... things I was dealing with at the time, so...
Your stuff with Tragedy is killer, the first couple things you did with
right.
him.
Right.
Black and proud. Can't stop the pump rush. Blessed with a talented format. I'm kicking the earth like a doormat. The more I grow, the more I understand. And I don't really care about a grafted man.
So it was like, there was a lot going on with that, and... Yeah, I believe the Keepers of the Funk was, I think, 95. That was right around the time I was doing the Youngsters, War and Now, and finishing up with Trash. Mm. So I had my hands full, and they actually didn't allow... I wasn't allowed on a project like I probably was on the first album. And more than likely, I could say definitively, Sample Clearance was definitely jumping aboard hardcore with us.
Yeah. You mentioned the Youngsters, obviously you did a ton of stuff with them. The song Mad Props you did with them. Maybe I'm misreading it, but I thought I read somewhere that that beat was maybe destined for Nas originally.
That was supposed to have been on Nas's Illmatic album. He picked that beat. Due to the powers that be, business just didn't get worked out. But we literally, you know, we sat down, you know, we had a meeting about it. He told me he loved the track. He wanted it on this album. And we just didn't get the business worked out, and it never happened. And then the Youngsters heard it, and that was it. But, yep, originally that was the case.
That's crazy. And then, you know, you had your group Real Live had, you know, reformed by that time.
Right.
And I know the record... that you did, I know that that's one of still your personal favorites in your
right
discography. Why? What's special about it?
We talking about Real Life Shit?
Real, yeah.
That's how I'm bouncing for the 9/5, son. We don't promote no masquerade because we was players from day one. We start trends, we make hits. K-Def and Larry O be on some Real Life Shit. I'll even fools like heroin in your nose. K-Def and Larry O be on some Real Life Shit.
Oh, Real Life Shit was like, that was probably the first track that no matter where I went, where I was at, before the record even came out, no matter where I went, who I played it for, the response was like you being at a metal rock concert and they're doing slam dancing and they're just going wild and crazy. I was getting a reaction from pretty much everybody who heard it. And what made it so special about that, it was 5:30 in the morning, Larry sleep on my couch, and I find that album, and I hit that sound, and the first thing I told Larry was, wake up, I got a joint. Oh, come on, man, leave me alone, man. You know, what are you talking about? Bro, I got one. And he got up, and he heard it, and immediately, as soon as the beat came on, 5:30 in the morning, birds is chirping. He immediately wanted to start writing to it right then in the spot. And I'll never forget the reaction we got from Atlantic Records when they heard the song as well. And for some reason, that one song, I've heard every fan, producer, rapper, freestyle over it, DJ on it, try to make a beat from it, do everything. And, you know, it felt good to be able to do something where it was orchestrated. It wasn't just a jazz sample. It wasn't a funk or soul. It was like no one is going to do what I just did on this. This was one of them. I did a lot of smoking, and the song had not no beat, no pattern, no nothing. It was like hit here, string 2 minutes down, and then another string about 5 minutes down the song, and it was an African primitive record. It was nothing but just chaos of African primitive music. You know what I'm saying? Where it started off with a bongo by itself, and then it'll end up with a orchestrated whoo, and then cut off. And I don't know. I just, that one right there, I think, gave me the most satisfaction that Dr. Dre sampled it, too.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Hey, yo, that shit sounds dope. Hey, yo, Kim, what you got to say?
I do have to ask about something about Real Live, which is you guys were signed to Big Beat for a bit and then weren't because of something your cousin did. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, very disappointing. We just did a tour. We did a promo tour. We just got back from BET. I think we did a East Coast tour. And I'll never forget, we was in North Carolina, and things were a little tight financially. And not for me per se, but my cousin. And, you know, he wanted to take some matters in his own hands. And he decided that he wanted to go up at Atlantic and kind of do a bully tactic. And which I didn't have no knowledge of at the time. And it turned to shit real quick. And Craig Kalman and my manager hit me up, and they were like, yo.
I also went all the way to the top immediately.
Yeah. They called me up immediately, and it was like, Real Live is done. No deal. We're pulling the album off the shelves. You guys are not allowed in the building. And it was just like, what? What in the world is going on, man? And I'm like, yo, I had nothing to do with that. I said, dude, I just got a daughter, man. I mean, yo, I need this right here. This is what I worked with Marley and all my shit going. This is what it was. And yeah, it was really, really bad that, you know, we didn't have records in the stores like we should have. And that probably was part of the promotion radio department, because that's your job. You go and do promo tours. You figure, you know, you're going to be in an in-store. Your record is going to be in the store. And when it's not in there, you're like, okay, what happened? Why is my record not in the store? You know, and that stuff was aggravating after some time, going to state to state to state. And I guess it was a boiling point, which it wasn't right, you know. But
You were also hardly the only rappers in the 90s to run up in your record company's office.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was weird. That's all I can tell you. It was a weird moment. And till this day, it's like I get people every now and then ask me about it. And, you know, they're like, yo, what possessed that, you know, to transpire? And I'm like, you know, under the circumstances, man, you know, underground hip hop wasn't getting the love that you thought you saw because you seen the video or you heard the record on the radio. You know, it was about your record being places where you could get new shows. You know what I'm saying? When you're doing a promo tour, you're not getting paid. So you're basically at your own expense with per diem from the record label, and you're kind of doing your own thing. And, you know, it was a little tight. And it was like, you know, I understand what he felt with his pain, but the way he did it, I just felt could have been done a lot differently. And it probably wouldn't have ruined our record deal. But yeah, it did happen. It definitely did happen. And, you know, I wasn't there to go, you know, phrase by phrase with it as far as what actually happened and transpired. But from what I've been told, it was really ugly. And, you know, Craig Kalman was like, yo, guys are done. I love you, Kay. I'm going to rock with you. I'm going to get you hooked up with Fat Joe and do some drums and do this, that, and the third. But as far as Real Life, and that was that. And, yeah, never forget, that was just like, we came out of the album in 96. And we were deaded in 96. Amazing, right?
About production and like your approach to production, because it's so interesting and it's gone through so many changes.
Right.
I wanted to ask about something, which is like, take, you know, the a song you did with the Youngsters, for example, like Take Backstabbers, for example.
Right.
To me, it sounds like you took the organ on that tune, the sort of, you know, chord progression on the organ, and then the sort of two-note riff on the guitar. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like they're from separate places. Sucker, this and that, but it's a whack damn sucker. I'm not going to fall, keep climbing like a ladder. Till the day you die, you're still a backstabber. A backstabber.
Oh, the brand, that's something different, right?
Yeah.
From right.
Yeah, from where you got the organ. Not even that song specifically, but that process generally is what I was interested in. How do you meld pieces together from separate songs?
Okay, so there may be a few that know, or they might not know, but I had a copy of Return of the Boom Bap a year before it came out. I had Illmatic a year before it came out. I had Midnight Marauders a year before it came out. So Tribe was probably one of my biggest inspirations before Dre stepped into the scene. And my MO was, when I was making my tracks, I wanted grooves. I like melody grooves. I know the hard stuff was what, you know, most of the rappers wanted and everything, but I was into melodical grooves. I was trying to find certain records and figure, we can't time stretch and pitch shift, which I could though, because I was using an Eventide. But besides that, I would sample little pieces of samples, and when I had to tune them down, because you had to speed everything up in 45, because you ain't had that much sample time. So when I was slowing all the way down, when you finally get the right tempo for your track, some of them just actually harmonically fit whatever you had going as the main loop. And I wasn't even into music like that. I was like a gamble. But when you had so many jazz records had all kind of phases to it. You had some that had drum breaks, but then you had some that had just some cymbal rides going in, and it was just a guitar, you know, or it was just a horn with a bass note from Ron Carter playing in there. It was like you would take these little pieces, and I was just so pressed, man, because I had so many artists. Like, I had who I loved to listen to, and then I had all these artists that were coming in the house. And I didn't have time to sit back and think about too much other than, the more beats I make, the more people's going to take them. And I just kept doing it and doing it. Like I said, I made a lot of whack joints where dudes wasn't feeling it like that. But then it was some, like you just alluded to, where it was like, well, what made you put this together? Soon as those guys heard it, they automatically knew that was the one. You couldn't talk them out of it. You couldn't tell them, well, nah, I still need to add here and fix. Nah, don't do nothing. Leave it the way it is. And you know what? That's how they ended up the way they did. Some of them were not even finished beats. But once a rapper hears something, if you say, oh, yo, I wanna put another kick drum here. Yo, don't touch that beat, yo. You know, you'll have a problem. You know what I'm saying? They would really take it serious. Like, yo, dude, leave the beat alone. It's dope the way it is. Just let it rock. I don't care how you did it. It just sounds great. Leave it the way it is. So it's like, okay, cool. And back then, it was a beat maker. It wasn't the producer. You know what I'm saying? I was more of a beat maker. Didn't pay too much attention to the rhymes because that wasn't my department. You know what I'm saying? I was the producer on the record, but I'm just saying I was more the beat maker because I didn't care about, you know, what is he actually saying on this beat right here? I don't really care about it. It is what it is. He likes the beat. Fine. I love it too. Great. Let's just do it. And then it was only until like around the World Now time and all that where I started paying more attention to making my samples coincide with what they're saying, so it doesn't sound like we got two meshes of just crap. You know what I'm saying? That's how you end up with album cuts, if you didn't know. The album cuts are when you didn't pay attention to the rapper, and the rapper didn't pay attention to what was going on in the music. He was infatuated with the moment. And that's what usually most of the artists were infatuated with, the moment. Oh, I'm here, the house of hits, doing this, blah, 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 blah. That's it. It wasn't about, am I going to make a hit record here, or I'm just doing a record? So, you know, a lot of the samples, I can't say they were automatically, I knew what pitch and key was till later down the line. But back then, it was like, when I turned the tune down some, hey, guess what? If it fit, and it sounded weird, but it sounded like it wasn't too out of key, and it just sounded like it magically fit, let's roll with it.
You said one time that you thought a lot of the way hip-hop sounded during this period and right before the kind of golden age into your time with Marley had to do with the limitations of the SP-12. And so for people who aren't producers, maybe aren't, you know, wouldn't necessarily understand, what did you mean by that?
Well, the SP-12 was like 2.5 seconds. I don't know what the 1200 was. It got stolen before I could keep it long enough to have it. It got stolen out of the car at Rutgers University. But back then, you didn't have a lot of time. And you really had to selectively take pieces. You couldn't just do, oh, I'm going to sample a four-bar loop. That wasn't happening. So, you know, nowadays, you know, the people that worship the machines, it's like some of them got more memory, but except for that 1200, which it doesn't, you know, I don't know how much you can actually get out of a couple of seconds time and how you're going to have a complete beat. You know, all the beats that were made back then on those machines, you got to understand, they were on boards with 24-track tape machines that they would do one pass, go back, sample some more, add another, and then add that on to the 2-inch tape. You know, now, you know, it's like just using a machine one time by itself, you're not getting the full grasp of what it was back then. So, you know, it's hard to really say you got a produced record when you only got like 5 second sample time and you just basically got drums and a loop.
And, you know, one of the things that's been so distinctive about your productions is a lot of them, you know, have an intro, right? 4 or 8 bars or so before the drums kick in.
Right.
Like a lot of your signature songs will have that.
Not me, word is born. My nigga Marley Marl and such, we up in here. Putting it down for y'all, you know what I mean? Getting it this. What? 9-7. It's like this. It's for the family, blood, like truth, crime.
What's the secret to a good intro?
Climax. You are fooling the ear to think that something is about to happen. You don't know what's about to happen, but something is about to happen. Usually I try to make intros where they're calm and subtle. And then right at the very end of the bar, before that beat comes in, that snare comes in and it's pop, boom. As soon as it comes in, it's automatically like, it's a fire, it's a riot, move out the way, get out the way. And it's like, I always... build up was always a thing with me because some records that just come flat on with the music and all used to be great, but I felt like everybody else was doing that and I wanted to be different. And I felt like there were certain records where, you know, for instance, The Choice Is Yours. You know, it started off with a bass line. Dun, 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 and then it's like, and then he comes in, and then it's just this whole bunch of drum beat and little, oh, come on! Oh, it was drama. So it's like, I always felt like the action of the song coming in highlights the rapper and makes you stay engaged. As in, if you give that away in the first 5 to 10 seconds of the song, the people know what to expect by the time the rap comes in. And that wasn't, to me, interesting, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Now, you were talking about sample time a second ago. You got out of the game of drum machines earlier than a lot of your peers and kind of jumped into computers.
All right. The Doggy Dog World album made me wake up.
Yeah, that's another thing, actually, if I can jump into that, I wanted to get into, is you said that you heard Gin and Juice probably a year before it came out. And when you heard it, you turned to Marley and you said, it's over.
Yeah, it was literally over. And, you know, luckily for me, I came in the 90s and the early 90s where it was just everybody was sample crazy and everything. And when I heard him use I Get Lifted, it had this orchestrated, everything is in key sounds going along with it.
With so much drama in the LBC, it's kind of hard being Snoop D-O-double-G, but I... somehow, some way, keep coming up with funky ass shit like every single day. May I kick
and I'm like, yo, this record is not going to blow up, but it's going to shut down anybody that's been doing the sample stuff the way they've been doing it, and make more attention to know that, you know what? You have to take this form. Dre took the form of the regular sampling thing and made it seem like, you know what? We're making complete body of records that's going to impact the ear. And you know what? We're not going to talk about what Gin and Juice did. I was dead on it. And after that, I said, you know what? How long am I going to keep doing this style, what I'm doing? And it's only gone but so far. You know, I mean, I had some pretty well-known top artists, and it was only getting props. It was like one point, you get to a point where it's like, enough props, man. I want to make a smash. I want to make a longevity smash. And, you know, when I heard that and then the whole album, it was just like I was dead on. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to get this out of these machines. I'm just not going to get it. I don't care. I could have the cleanest record, no pops and all that shit. And you know what? The end of the day is I'm not going to be able to get that. This guy's got a bass line and he's got some crazy strings and some weird effects. And it's like I'm not finding these sounds on records. I don't have time to sit here and find those sounds on records when I know already they're not records. They're actually musicians going in and playing. Computers came into the scene for me when an engineer that we had at the House of Hits called Frank Heller. He was always ranting and raving about Cubase because he was like, yo, Cubase can time stretch stuff crazy. Well, you can't even notice it. And I'm like, blah, blah, blah. My S3000 time stretches and pitch shift. And he's like, yeah, but they don't do it this good. He kept raving and raving and raving about it. So one day I was like, yo, I'm coming by your house. Went by his house. And I'll never forget, he took, I think it was either, what was it? A rap record. And the rap record, I believe, was like 101. And he's time stretched it to 90.
And so it was slowed like, it down.
Yeah,
10,
he slowed it down to
90
BPM. Yeah. And I'm like, what the world is this? He's like.
Without changing the pitch or the voice or
it
anything.
It was perfectly tacked, no garbled Darth Vader sound and warbly. No, I was like, yo, this is crazy. I'm like, you know how many beats I can make? And right then and there, I knew already it was time for me to get it. So in 97, I got rid of my MPC 3000. And people must understand that. Even though I'm from that generation, they got to understand, I got more MPC beats right now than the average guy that went and got his MPC and he makes beats. I got way more beats that nobody has never heard that I've used so many. I put like this. It's like, I like Nowlators and I ate every color of Nowlators. You know what? I'm just tired of Nowlators. I want some sugar daddies or something. You know what I'm saying? And it's not that I'm not knocking it. I never knocked the machines, and that's great. But when you, from that era, you made all your music from those machines, and you got a ton more, it just tells you how much time I spent on the machines.
I mean, you have at least two volumes so far of your Beats from the 90s series.
I got two volumes of that. I just bounced down 90 more beats, and I have another 80 more that has to get bounced down from the MPC 3000 and S3000. And, you know... I get why everybody likes the 12-bit grid and 16-bit grid. I get that. But when you've done it so much, you say, I've outgrown it. I will still do it if I need to do it, but I've outgrown it because there's more to technology. And you know what? Technology has prevailed. We got Cubase. We got Logic. We got Reason. We got Ableton. You got a bunch of stuff that everybody's using now. And you know what? Who would have thought that back then when those machines were out? Everybody lived and died and thought that this was all it was going to be. This was going to be hip-hop. Hip-hop is going to be stuck here. And you know what? It's not. You got the machine. You got the MPC Renaissance. You got all this stuff now, and it's great, but it's still computer-orientated. And you know what? We can't change that. You know, people want to hear clear stuff. They don't want to hear something that sounds like you got bacon and eggs frying. And, you know, it's the 12-bit grit. I get that. But the today's listener... They want to hear the synth sound clarity. That's what they're adjusted to. They're not adjusting to the old, yo, it's got to have the pops and the grit and this and that. Yeah, you get a regular listener that hears that, you know what they're going to tell you? Something doesn't sound right with that. Why does it sound like that? It doesn't sound, something's
right,
wrong.
Well, if you hear three songs,
they're not
going
to tell you what's wrong with it, but they're going to say it's something wrong. And it's not wrong for them to say that because even me, you know, in 1990, we didn't have the clickers and denoises and restoration. We didn't have that. That's what we had. We had those machines. That's what they gave us. That's all we had. But come on. We're in 2015. Come on.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about some of the later stuff, you know, after you switched the computer, you know, you did a song with Diddy. You did We Gonna Make It, right? Right. And so, unfortunately for you, it uses the exact same sample as Jay-Z's big post-retirement comeback single, Show Me What You Got, that was released that same year. I don't know how close...
Exactly,
very close.
Yeah.
Exactly, cool. So you get this giant placement with Diddy, and it's, you know, he's a top artist and he's doing this press play record. It's so exciting. And then what, can you take me back to when you first heard Show Me What You Got?
I was very, I could literally say it. When I first heard Show Me What You Got, I thought it was some kind of conspiracy thing going on with me. Cause it was just like, this is too good to be true. You know, that's something that you don't think of. Coincidence, maybe, but nah, you know. And once again, you know, doesn't mean that, you know, no one owns a sample. I get it. But it was just kind of ironic that, you know, at that particular time, you know, Budweiser's behind Jay's commercial. And he has like 20 million.
I was going to say, yeah, it wasn't just a single. It had its own TV commercial.
Right. It was pretty much 20 million behind that record.
Jay-Z had teamed up with Budweiser for the release of Show Me What You Got. The beer company named Jay its co-brand director for Budweiser Select, and the company made a television commercial featuring Jay, Dale Earnhardt Jr., and Danica Patrick, a longer version of which doubled as a music video for the song.
And, you know, whatever Diddy had, but
yeah,
Diddy was amped on the song. I was amped on the song. I thought it was going to be a great record for me. I was excited, you know, and it was a tough break for me, man, but it still didn't break my will. You know, as I know already at the end of the day is, you know, it could not even have made the album, but Diddy was adamant about it saying, look, we're going to still use this record and we're going to still move forward with it regardless of what it is. And that's all I could really go on, you know what I'm saying? But it was definitely a moment for me. That I had to really go, wow, this is crazy. New Kids on the Block use it.
KDEF actually means Kids in the Hall with their track, Don't Stop.
A step up from project steps, a step towards the unknown, sidestep mediocrity, I'm gone. Basically, back.
Jay use it, and they all drop at the same damn time? What is this?
Wait, 2006 was apparently a year really? Of Shaft in Africa this? Or something, I don't know.
And Johnny Pate is the one sitting on the probably a brand new house, three cars, and going, oh, this is wonderful.
Yeah.
Because he ripped me with the publishing. So
I'm sure. I mean, speaking of Shaft in Africa, like you have a real thing. You know, you talked before about buying a ton of blaxploitation movies, and you did that record, The Fool, that was kind of like almost like a soundtrack to imaginary
right.
blaxploitation movie.
Right.
I could get killed just crossing the street or get mugged in the hall. When it's time for you to go, you're gone no matter where you're at.
Don't you want to settle down and get married, raise a family, live a normal life?
I would love all that kind of shit, but how can you live a normal life when your so-called brothers are breaking it off?
What is it about that era of film, that era of like the soundtracks to that film that grabs you?
I love drama and action. I love things that stimulate your nervous system where, you know, you can't just sit still. Makes you either tense, makes you feel, you know, some sort of edginess going on. You know, like, oh, I'm walking down this alley right now. It's pretty dark. Hopefully nothing jumps out at me. I gotta brace myself. You know, I like to give you that kind of feeling. But also be melodical with it and not... And those movies, man, those movies were like, you know... I'm going to be honest with you. You know, a lot of that stuff has never been used. A lot of that stuff has never been heard. A lot of those movies are just hard to find. and I'm into the obscurity stuff. So I like to be weird with it, you know. I don't want somebody to go, oh, I know what that break is. I used it. You know, it happens because, you know, everybody's into records. I got it. But when the movies were, a lot of that stuff wasn't on records, strictly in the movie. So I used to just love taking stuff that was like, oh, yo, wow. 45 King put me up on a movie, speaking of Willie Boo the Fool, and one of the tracks I used with that. But there was a movie, a John Wayne movie. Don't ask me why, how he knew that. But it was a John Wayne movie, and it had the funkiest break I've heard in probably years. And he was like, yeah, you know, go ahead, if you use it, you know, you like it, I'll give it to you. You know what I'm saying? And to this day, not too many people know about the movie because it was never a soundtrack. So I try to find things that weren't soundtracks, and I know already you either have to know the movie or watch the movie to kind of know what it is. And, you know, it's about the sample clearance thing, you know? You got to be careful, you know what I'm saying? So it's like trying to be, the obscurer you are, the less likely you're going to have any problems. You know, I have a name, so, you know, it's not like I could just go and sample Barry White, Isaac Hayes, Bob James, and expect nobody not to say nothing. So sure. I got to be a little bit more, you know, and through the years. And by the way, my Black Exploitation right now collection is about 300 gigs.
Wow. But you're not averse to using well-known movie themes, right? You sort of updated the Psycho and the Godfather themes in various records.
Right, The Godfather, there's about 500 versions.
Yeah.
So I got a version, what was that? I don't like to give away my samples, but in this particular situation, let's just say it was an Al Caliola version of The Godfather. And that was pretty, it was pretty cool, man. It was a pretty cool joint and mean, like, it was really, really interesting. And I liked interesting stuff. I liked the stuff that just not common and familiar, you know, and try to be the first one to crack at it before everybody else gets a wind of what it is. So that was my MO. And I love the movies because there's always breaks in there and they'll never be on vinyl. And it's hard to find a movie. So it's like, if I can get credit and somebody go, yo, this joint was crazy, I wonder where you got it from, you'll be looking for a long time.
Yeah. And you did an absolutely killer Ghostface song, It's Over.
Oh, wow.
From the Pretty Tony record.
I heard a voice through a bullhorn, a white man. He said, yo, stop, you're surrounded. Put down your gun. Look at the rules. It's none but cops, nigga. You better not run.
And there's kind of an amusing story behind that, right? Because it's a replay of a David Porter tune.
It's a replay of it, and Seth Michonne of World Renown did the hook and sung the vocals along with this girl, Joaquina. And they did the whole hook part of it. It was originally a Seven Sean record, and things didn't fall right with it. And, you know, Ghost happened to hear it. Ghost wanted it. And it was a replay. And everybody thought, you know, even Universal thought that I sampled it. And when they found out it was a replay, I eventually got the multi of the original record. So I thought that was kind of cool. But I started replaying then because it was just getting out of hand. You know, it was just like, wow, guys, you guys just, they just stay on me for sample clearances. If I do anything too familiar that they know, it's, oh, that's so-and-so. And then, you know, I got to deal with the letters. And
is that why you did the One Man Band album, which is kind of the One Man Band album for people who haven't heard it, is like reinterpretations, not exactly strict replays, but kind of reinterpretations of stuff by, you know, David Axelrod, Stevie Wonder, stuff that's kind of in the samplable canon. Why did you do that record? It's kind of an unusual approach to an album.
I wanted to show the producers, the audience, that, you know, I want to put music to you where it's familiar to you. I didn't want to do something so obscure that nobody even knows what it is. But I wanted to do things that you go, oh, yeah, Tribe Called Quest. Oh, but wait a minute. Tribe Called Quest didn't have an instrumental to this. Wait a minute, this doesn't sound quite like Tribe Called Quest's. Or it doesn't quite sound like, it sounds like David Axelrod, but... wow, it doesn't sound like, but it's funky. I'm liking this. And I want to give the producers and the artists a vision to go, you know what? You guys can do the same thing. If people idolize the 90s and the golden era and know that we can't just go and flat out sample these records, but there are bands, there are great programmers, and we do have virtual instruments now that have really great sounds and we can really do some phenomenal stuff, give you an idea to go like, look, just because it sounds like it, or it gives you a memory of it, it also lets you know that it's not it. And you can do the same thing with your own selection of choice of whatever records you want to use and be able to be like, oh, wow. You know what? You give the people a sense to go, not only did they bring it back, but the producer's saying, I'm not going to get sued. All right? Because if they want me to turn in my master of an infringement, they're going to find out clearly this is not anything from my master. You got to give the guy props because he did a great, pretty good job of giving you the feel of it, an interpretation of it, or a mood of it, but yet and still giving the new artist a chance to relive that moment in the 90s. And like I said, I just gave that album an example of where we could be at musically moving forward, since we have so many problems with copyright infringement and sample clearances and crap, which is limiting the, let's just say, the boom bap artists from re-emerging. It's killing us. Nobody talks about that, but that's the main problem is sample clearance and publishers. They're killing it. Copyright holders are destroying any hopes or beliefs of, you know, sampling. You know what I'm saying? And sampling is the art form that created part of hip-hop. It's part of the culture. And it's like, we got to do something. So, right. You know,
so,
I tried.
So for people who don't necessarily understand the business of it, it's kind of like if you sample something, if you want to release it, the people who control the song can ask for
whatever they want
and in terms of publishing money.
There's nothing you can do about it. You can say yay or nay. The bigger the artist, the more they want.
Right. We've had examples on the show of 88 Keys said he sampled Paul McCartney, who let him do it, but wanted literally 100%.
Right. And that story goes on and on and on. I believe Just Blaze had issues like that as well. Myself. You know what I'm saying? Just to take there, you know, I dealt with the problems when no one else was dealing with the problems. Like when I did Funky Child, you got to understand, I had James Brown in there. Not one sample, two samples. I had Moses thing from Fist of Say Pittsburgh, which that was part of a movie soundtrack. We couldn't even use it. You can't even use nothing from no movie soundtracks. They doing it now today, which I don't know how, but back then they said, take out the record, you could replay it, and as long as you do the interpolation a little bit differently, you can get a pass on that. But James Brown, Bob James, and all those guys, Barry White, Isaac Hayes.
I've heard Barry White is...
Barry White destroyed me.
Barry White has long been one of the most expensive artists to sample, with fees ranging from $10,000 to $30,000. He also did not permit artists to replay any of his songs, which would have brought the cost down. Replays are cheaper because if a sample is replayed, then none of the original performers have to be paid, and the license to use just the composition is comparatively cheap. It's no more expensive than licensing a cover version.
He destroyed me. But I'm just saying, the end of the day is, I was dealing back that in the 90s. And now people now are like, you know, before it was 4 seconds of sample time. Now it's one. You can get sued for one. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, you know, nobody cared about it until now. You know what I'm saying? And now it's like, yo, dude, do whatever you're going to do, but leave Thunder and Lightning alone. Leave Bob James alone. Leave Barry White alone. Leave Isaac Hayes alone. Leave any well-known artist that they leave Patrice Rushen alone. I can keep going down the list that they're just not down with hip-hop at all. You know what I'm saying? I mean, to the point where they'll tell you, no, we don't want you to use it because you just said something derogatory about women. You know, that simple. You know what I'm saying? Forget about how much of the song you use, what part of it you use. They listening to your lyrics. You know what I'm saying? It's like, really, dude? Is that serious? So it's gotten so bad now that, I mean, I'll be honest with you. If you're new and you're upcoming and you're doing it, man, I say this to everybody. They don't know you until you make a hit. Once you make a hit, you could have sampled 10 albums you would have came out with. Once you make a hit, they going back to every album you put out 10 years ago and try to, every publisher in the world is going to come after you. And that's just the way it is. And you know what? It's tough for this new generation to be able to relive that moment that we also loved back then, because now it's that tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. It's a different time for sample-based music than right. It was. So I couldn't let a chance to talk to you go by without asking you one last thing, which is, you know, we mentioned KRS earlier in the interview. We mentioned Prince B earlier in the interview. I think you see where this is going. You were there for a very famous hip hop moment that involved the both of them.
Right. We were, me and Larry O was with Chris. We was in Battery Studios, and Chris came through with the Source magazine. He slapped the magazine on the table. He said, read that. And I just opened the magazine up. Me and Larry's looking at it. It says, KRS-One is a teacher, but a teacher of what?
Prince B said that now infamous quote about KRS-One in a 1991 issue of Details magazine, just a few months prior to the Sound Factory show discussed here.
As soon as I wrote that, read that, Chris said, we're going to the Sound Factory tonight. Really? And never forget, I remember Leaders of New School was there performing. Dinkle D passed out from dehydration. There was Latifah was there. I believe Positive K was there. There were a lot of people in that place that night. And I remember, you know, PM Dawn gets on and Chris goes, wait. That's not the joint. So at this point, my heart is starting to beat a little bit, because he was like, basically, we're waiting for that record. And when he finally went and did that record, he said, now we're ready to go. And I'll never forget going on stage, me, Larry O, my man Black, we're on stage, and there's Willie D and ICU, and both of them just pick Prince B up, lift him up, and throw him into the crowd. The whole crowd moves away. Chris grabs the mic, says, Kenny, bring that down. And I hear I'm Still Number One come on. That's just that. One. He did about a half a verse. The crowd is like, wah! And then, pop, 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 pop. Me and my man Black is running down 12th Ave. Scared as shit, running down, because it was just automatic mayhem. But that was something that I could literally say that, you know, I never thought hip-hop would get to that, but I happened to be there at that moment, and what I felt was that this dude, Chris, was just like, yo, he was the real deal. And to this day, I got mad respect to dude for that, because it was just like, you know, he showed people, it was like, look, you know, I'm not advocating violence, but you just attack me in a point publicly in a magazine that the world's seeing. It's not just somebody locally. And, you know, he did it with I'm Still Number One record, which I thought was...
Pieced together from several sources, including Drez of Black Sheep, Cool Kim of the UMCs, and KRS-One's brother and DJ Kenny Parker, here is what appeared to have gone down at the concert. PM Dawn was starting their set for a multi-artist show being filmed for MTV. Black Sheep, leaders of the New School, Nice and Smooth, and Supercat were among the other artists performing there. KRS-One and BDP were not supposed to be performing, however. In the middle of a performance of PM Dawn's crossover hit, Set Adrift on Memory Bliss, BDP and their entire crew, including Just Ice, D-Nice, ICU, Willie D, Kenny Parker, and even Tretch and other members of Naughty by Nature, came up on the stage. KRS-One took the mic from Prince B, who attempted to calm KRS down and talk peace. There was some dispute here about whether Chris hit Prince B with the mic, but then a fight broke out. In the commotion, they took over the turntables and threw Prince B off the stage. KRS-One and BDP then proceeded to perform three songs, including The Bridge is Over, with lyrics tailored to diss PM Dawn like The Dawn is Over, The Dawn is Over, and Still Number One. As for Prince B's diss of KRS-One, KRS-One later told USA Today, I answered his question. I'm a teacher of respect.
I mean, you with the guy in the studio earlier prior, and then you're in the sound factory, and there's a guy getting thrown on stage right in front of your eyes, and you're sitting there going, what the fuck is going on right now? What is this? And Larry's like, yo. I'm like, yo. I'm like, this is crazy. And you know what? The end of the day is, that was one of the most fearful nights that I could say that I've incurred. I mean, I was at the Raising Hell tour with Run DMC up in the Garden, and that was a scary moment as well. That was actually probably scarier. But,
What was that?
What? The Raising Hell tour?
I mean, I know that in L.A. they had problems.
During the Los Angeles show of the 1986 Raising Hell Tour, there was what Spin Magazine called a gang-related mini-riot that stopped the show and left 40 people injured. You can hear a first-person account from Lisa Cortez in Cypher Episode 92.
Oh, no, New York was off the chain. LL Cool J. Public Enemy started it. Yeah, Public Enemy started. Public Enemy said something like, F the Klan. And I'll never forget in there, you had a couple of mezzes up in the arena. So you got the upper mezz, lower mezz, whatever, right? So just think about this. Envision this and close your eyes and think about this. You got about 50 dudes from Queens running around in a circle. You got another 50 from the Bronx running around in a circle. You got another one from Harlem and them running around a circle and anything in between. And they're all running around through the whole night, ripping girls' earrings out their ears, snatching dudes' chains off their necks, dudes getting sliced in their back with razor blades right in front of you. And you're sitting there and you're going, yo, what the hell's going on? All night long. And Public Enemy says, F the Klan. Look to the person next to you and say, F the Klan. And it just got so crazy in there that I think when LL was doing this, he was like, LL said, yo, put the L's in the air. Put your L's in the air. Me, my brother, and another dude, while everybody was putting their L's in the air, we got the hell up out of there. Because we didn't want to be there when it was over because you know already you got an exit. You got the hallway exit, and that exit is real tight. So I'm like, they acting this crazy right now, and it's like this many people are here. I'm like, you got the Bronx, you got Brooklyn, you got Queens, and they all a crew of dudes. And every time they would clash against each other, they would start fighting. So it was just like, this is just like being in like ultimate chaos. And it was like there were fights, people getting thrown over the mess. I'm like, oh, this is just unreal. And I was young, man. I was like, what, the Raising Hell tour had to be, what, 84, 83, 84? I was like 13, something like that, 14. I was young. So I'm scared out of my mind. I'm like, I ain't got no gun. I ain't got no knife. I guess me and my brother, who we going? What? Huh? What? My brother was pretty big, but seriously, like, yo, I don't want to watch the show anymore. I think I want to get out of here. My brother's like, yeah, I think we might want to leave while LL's up rocking because, yeah, I think that I never seen so much. I mean, the cops couldn't even get to the things that were happening in there. It was so bad. And it was just like, yo, this is like, and I can understand why they stopped doing a lot of those events because they really didn't have it under control. And you know what? I could literally say I was feared for my life up in there. Like, Chris was one thing because they started shooting and everybody just said, oh, go out to the back door. It was one thing. But when you're stuck in an arena and you know that already, I got to come down the stairs to get to that little floor, to get to the outside hallway, to then get to the either stair or the escalator thing to get down and get out. I got to go through all that to get out. I'm like, something bad can happen. And you know what? I'd never seen so much blood and just, oh man, it was frightening. I keep it real. It was really frightening. And I tell you what, I can understand why the Nassau Coliseum and Madison Square Garden did it all that kind of events. I think it was something with Puffy up in town in Harlem with Heavy D, and it was an event. I think people got trampled or something. I think that's when they really deaded it totally. But before that, the Nassau Coliseum, I believe, where Rakim was there, it was just mayhem. But yeah, the Raising Hell tour in Madison Square Garden was probably one of the scariest moments of my life. I wanted to enjoy the show, but I was really worrying about my life in there because I never been, like, I'm from Jersey. I'm in Manhattan, but I'm in Manhattan with every borough in New York's the tri-state area there. So very wild moment.
Wow. Well, that seems like a great note to end on, KDef. Thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. All right.
One of the great things about hosting this show is getting to uncover the hidden stories in just tiny little details of a song. One great example is the trumpet line in Funky Child. I had no idea that asking about one lick on one song would lead to a whole discussion of bootleg movies, blaxploitation, John Wayne, and tons of other stuff. Also, hearing KDef's efforts towards making sample-based music viable again gave me a lot of hope. I definitely recommend you check his one-man band album out for yourself to find out the direction he's headed in. After the interview, we also got a fantastic demonstration of his ability to pull individual tracks out of old songs for sampling, which is something I won't soon forget. Join us in 2 weeks when we talk to photographer Joe Conzo. The New York Times called him the man who took hip-hop's baby pictures, and they weren't exaggerating. Whether it's his high school buddies, the Cold Crush Brothers, tearing up a stage, the filming of the classic movie Wild Style, or even close-ups of Latin music legends like Tito Puente and Celia Cruz, Joe Conzo has seen it all and has the pictures to prove it. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, make sure you subscribe to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, a rating or review will also do us a hell of a lot of good. If you want to take an extra step in supporting the show, visit us at patreon.com/thecipher show and make a donation. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way.
As promised, here are the details about the contest. Again, to enter, just email your answers to contest@thecipher show.com by September 7th, 2015. By doing so, you'll be automatically entered in a drawing where we'll randomly select 3 winners to get some special stuff from Redefinition artists KDef and Damu the Fudge Monk. All 3 will get KDef's Tape 2 cassette and Damu's Public Assembly Volume 2 2 CD set. One grand prize winner will also get Tape 2 on vinyl. And if I know John, I'm sure there will be an extra sticker or other materials in there that he'll grab while packing up in the Redefinition warehouse. Again, all you have to do is answer the 2 questions. Who got the beat that should have been on Illmatic? And what song does KDef think marked the end of sampling? And send us an email. Because of legal restrictions, the contest is only open to listeners with a mailing address in America. You can check out more information on our Facebook page or at this episode's page on thecyphershow.com. Thanks and good luck.
You can find The Cipher on pretty much any social media at The Cipher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this week's show, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. And you can find more information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, at thecyphershow.com. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I like Nowlators, and I ate every color of Nowlators. You know what? I'm just tired of Nowlators.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
There were fights, people getting thrown over the mess. Ah! Blah, blah, blah.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
You know, you can't just sit still.
Special thanks, of course, to John at Redefinition Records for making this episode happen.
That was weird.
And an extra special thanks to our biggest Patreon donor of the month, Vikram.
We got to understand today's generation is a little blessed today.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
I was like, yo, we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here.
Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow, the laws were stern and justice stood, and people were behaving like they ought to good, there lived a little boy who was misled by another little boy, and this is what he said. Me and you, Ty, we're going to make